If you need to go down, I think it's the five components of existence, I think was the last one, which I did. So you've got that, we just start from there. Okay, excellent. Does that make sense to people who's got good memories? I think that's about right. Okay, so here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So I usually say that when reading out suttas. And of course, as I mentioned last time, which I gave the class, these suttas, which I'm reading out now, is a compilation. Is that somebody got a bad stomach from lunch? Okay. Oh, it must be Mara. Just disturb things. These suttas are a translation, and there's differences in the words which I use than you are probably accustomed to, and there's reasons for that, and I will give those reasons as we come to them. And this is the second time I've gone through the word of the Buddha here, but the last time was a couple of years ago, and some of those words and explanations have changed, so it is slightly different than what you heard before. And so we start off with, we had the First Noble Truth, a little bit of the First Noble Truth, and then we get to part of the First Noble Truth, is that five components of existence, the khandhas, usually translated as the five aggregates or the five groups. But to me, that does not really express the meaning of these khandhas, because the reason they are formed, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, is these become the components of what we take to be either a human being or sometimes any other beings. They're five khandha beings. And later on, well, maybe I might as well mention it now, that there are some beings who have only got four khandhas, which are sort of heavenly beings. People say in the arupa realm, people who get reborn in this realm based on jhanas, that their first khandha is absent. And there's also a type of being which is strange, but it's mentioned in the suttas, of the single khandha beings. And that's the asanya satta, the ones who have no perception, no consciousness, but they have almost like a mind-made body, almost like in limbo, until sort of they fall from that state and then get the other four khandhas back again. Just interesting, just the way of talking about these five khandhas as a way to somehow describe this phenomenon we call a human being, especially, and other beings as well. And in particular, how are these five components of existence suffering? Because this falls under that first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering, dukkha. So, and how in particular are the five components of existence suffering? They are as follows: the body, number two, experience, number three, perception, number four, will and other mental formations, and the six, consciousnesses, is the fifth of the khandha. These are the five components of existence that are suffering. And straight away there, you should notice that rupa, the body, that's a standard translation for that khandha, that component of existence. But vedana is usually translated as feeling. And basically that is missing a lot of what the word really means. Vedeti, which is the verb which is associated with this noun, vedana, Vedeti means to feel, to know, to experience. And so Vedana really means just the whole extent of things which we can experience through our senses, including the sixth sense, of course. And instead of just trying to classify it as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, it is more appropriate to actually not focus on the classification, but the thing it's supposed to be classifying, experience itself. So when you call Vedana as experience, rather than the types of experience, it gives a more meaningful description, an explanation of what the second khanda is. The third khanda of perception, that's standard, and really I don't think you can improve upon that. The fourth khanda of sankhara, that's variously translated, but the main part of that is this thing which we call will. And when we do start translating it really directly as will, it actually also changes much of the meaning of this Dhamma, these teachings of the Buddha, especially with regard to the five components of existence. This is a really essential part of this thing which we take to be us. And the Vijnana, as also Vijnana, is always the fifth khanda, is consistently translated as the six types of consciousness. So thereby I translate here, render it the six consciousnesses. And by making it a plural there, consciousnesses, it also avoids the trap of thinking that consciousness is some transcendental reality which can exist outside of the other khandhas and which can somehow explain some permanent essence, a soul. So when you call it six consciousnesses rather than one consciousness underlying everything, it does change the whole idea of what the Buddha is trying to say here. So the five components of existence become the body, experience, perception, will, and six consciousnesses. And thereby you can understand what I know as a Buddha's meaning. This is what we take to be, this human being, this sentient experience, this body, me. And one of the reasons why there is a lot of overlap in this, obviously, these are not exclusive categories, but nevertheless, they are pointing to that part of the human experience, the human body, where we usually find attachment, we usually feel that this is where I am, this is me, this is who I am. The body or my experience, my perceptions, especially my will, the one we assume is in control of everything, and also the consciousness is that which knows. So anyway, these are called the five components of existence, and straight away the Buddha called them suffering, dukkha. Just such a general dukkha. Doesn't actually say that just only if they're in a sort of a bad mode are they dukkha. They say they're essentially all the time different forms of suffering. That is called the noble truth of suffering. Now there is another. Shall we pause there? Any questions on this so far? Yes, Ananda. Oh yeah, well, there's one existence with only one.
With only one khanda.
Yeah.
And is that so only a mind-made body you mentioned? And is that a very low level of existence because no consciousness, no perception?
It is a very high level of existence.
High level?
It is it's based on the fourth jhana experience.
Okay.
Just so still that your consciousness experience ceases. The five lower consciousnesses of the five senses have already ceased, and the mind consciousness now ceases as well. So still. And then, but the body is, a body is still there, a mind-made body. This is like the jhana realms. And so it's fascinating there that it's one reason why. Why is it there's another place where a person is asanya, but that is in the a non-percipient, that is in the state of cessation of perception and feeling, which is based on the immaterial attainments. So I was just talking just in passing with Ajahn Bhamali when he was talking last time on the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Now, why did the Buddha enter Parinibbana, disappear if you like, through the fourth jhana and not through the ninth state? That is a very fascinating question, and it's still not totally resolved, but it does seem to be that it's basically the ninth state, the neither perception nor non-perception, is so incredibly refined that basically that, you know, it's almost automatic. You can't make any resolution, you can't not make a resolution, you have to come back again. But the fourth jhana is a little bit more ability to stop, to say no. It's a similar experience to the state of neither perception nor non-perception. But nevertheless, there is that state of sanya, non-percipient beings, based on the fourth jhana.
These are quite different from those who anagamis get reborn.
Oh yes, very different.
They're quite far apart.
Yeah, very, very different, yes. The anagamis just do have a mind-made body. And they are often very percipient.
All five khandhas are
there? All five khandhas are there, yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Chris.
Bhante, which categories do auditory thinking and visual thinking fit into in terms of the
Oh, yeah, that's the, yeah, that is the stuff which comes in many of those, because they are subjects of perception. Perception is active in there.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's experience. Mm-hmm. It's part of the sixth sense experience. And it's also your consciousness of those things. But they are also part of what, you know, I called here mental formations.
A little bit of will in them.
Indeed. But sometimes you say, well, I don't will these things, these just come up. But they're the result of previous will. It is the sankhara is both the active part of willing and also the result of what you have willed. You have to, it's like the vipaka. It is the result of just how you've trained your mind or restrained your mind.
So when you get good samatha or shamatha, you can actually tease all those components out of any one of the...
You know, when you do sort of, it's not just samatha can suppress those experiences, but you do need to also have the insight as well to let them go totally. You're talking about these things like the karma vitaka, the thoughts of sensory experience or sensory pleasure, correct? Yeah.
So
those. So like any classification of, you know, the parts of this thing we call life, in particular human life, but it does also relate to all other forms of existence, ghosts and devas, animals and so on, that there is a lot of overlap between these five categories. They're not exclusive, but together the five of them are supposed to cover every aspect of existence. And of course later on, you know, we come to people trying to maintain that there is something beyond the components of existence. that the five components of existence do not cover everything, there's something outside of that. And that's something which the Buddha adamantly denied. But still, people argue about that, say there's something which is apart from the five khandhas.
So strong shamatha can be used to actually suppress them, or actually look at them and develop wisdom, is that right?
Suppress what, sorry?
So, you know, with strong shamatha, say for example you're going into a jhana or something like that, that stuff is suppressed.
No,
but it comes back.
Oh yeah, yes.
After the jhana.
Are you talking about the khandhas or the karma? I haven't understood your question, sorry.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused between these two here, but what I was saying is, you know, you were saying how the five khandhas, my question was auditory thinking or visual thinking,
yes.
And you say, okay, it's a mixture of a lot of these. So what I'm asking is, with good shamatha, can you actually see how they all form as an aggregate together to express themselves as visual thinking or ordinary thinking, auditory thinking?
With good samatha, the job of samatha is to refine the awareness, to strengthen it, so your mindfulness is much stronger. In the old poem, which I often quote, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, to hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. That was William Blake. That is a sign of just what strong mindfulness can do, to see so much detail in just like a grain of sand. So when the mindfulness, it's the mindfulness which does this, the samatha is the cause for strong mindfulness. When that empowers the mind, then you can actually see very deeply how these things arise, where they come from, why they arise. And there's another part of that, which is how Ajahn Chah would teach, that sometimes in a forest monastery where we'd always be spending hours sweeping the paths, once the path had been swept and it was like this white ribbon through the forest, because the soil was white sand in the northeast, once it was a white ribbon through the forest, if one leaf fell on that path, it would stand out. You could see it so clearly. It was a single leaf on a clear path. If that leaf fell in the forest, amongst so many different leaves and twigs and bushes, it would not stand out at all. It would be almost like overwhelmed by all the other stuff which is on the forest floor. And that was a simile, that if the mind has been calmed down, so there's hardly a thought in it at all, or long periods when there's no thoughts, then when one thought drops, it stands out, stays there until another leaf drops, so you can examine it, you have the time to be able to understand what this means.
Okay, then spontaneous wisdom arises as a result of what you just said.
And afterwards, by seeing those things, one sees that just how it's how to be able to calm the mind down. When you see the causes and you see the results are just suffering, they're just a problem, then it's the nature that one will not put one's hand in the fire when you know it burns.
Thank you.
It's not as if that you have to make a resolution and, you know, put effort into, I'm not going to put my hand in the fire anymore, I'm not going to put my hand in the fire anymore. Once you know it's suffering, you just automatically just keep your hand out of the fire. Yes.
Elsewhere in the suttas it mentions that form is suffering as well.
Yes, yeah.
And another whole group.
Yes. That rupa, form, body is suffering. And indeed, I don't know how old you are, Bill, but you know it is a lot of suffering. Simply because, you know, this body, it's no matter what you do, how you exercise it, what you eat, how much you rest, how much you don't rest, it's still just, it's a very difficult thing to actually to endure. And that becomes very clear to you when the form, the body, disappears. especially when you just get into one of these jhanas, when the five senses, which are how the body expresses itself. I think sometimes, I believe it was Ajahn Mahabua said this, but I cannot be sure, that this body is like the playground of the five senses. This is where seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touch just do their thing in this body. And when those five sort of things cease for a while, so does the body. And that's the experience of a first jhana and beyond. And that's one of the experiences of a first jhana, that the five senses are not there, they're absent, and it's the bliss, the happiness of that state, because you're not experiencing any of the five senses anymore. And that is why they call it vivekaja piti sukha. Vivekaja means born of, produced by being apart from the body, viveka, secluded from the body and the five senses. And so you get into these deep meditations, oh wow, this is blissful. Why? It's blissful because some amount of suffering is gone. It's just like you've been sort of walking through the 40 degree heat with a big backpack on, and finally you can get to the temple, you can put your backpack down and relax. A big burden is gone. That means it is happiness. Okay. So now this is the next part, is a well-known passage, which is does confuse some people, so that's why I put it here. Is the fuel, it's called upadana, sometimes called attachment, grasping, is the fuel what keeps the processes of khandhas going, the same as these five components of existence, or is the fuel something apart from the five components of existence? And this is where the Buddha sometimes called it upadana khanda and khanda, grasping khandhas and just khandhas. And this, it was the answer, that fuel is neither the same as the five components of existence, nor is the fuel separate from the five components of existence. It is the desire and wanting that is part of these five components of existence, that is the fuel that sustains them. I'm very careful with that translation to make it quite clear what the Pali is pointing to. Sometimes, upadana, it sometimes can mean sort of grasping, but it literally means, taking up. Upa is the same word in English as up, towards. And adana, as in the second precept, adina, which means not given, adana, where ramani sikapadang samadhiyami, taking what is not given. And the adana is taking. So upadana means taking up. Sometimes you could call that grasping. I've taken up, I've grasped the stick. But it also has this meaning, which is used very often, of like your car engine taking up the petrol, like the aircon taking up the electricity. It's what fuels it. And it's the fuel, that rendering, which is not my rendering, it's one of the alternative renderings for upadana, which is well known. That seems to be a meaning, a rendering, a translation, which makes this easier to understand. In other words, it is in those five khandhas, that contains, the fuel, which the next manifestation of the khandhas needs to bring it up. This is what keeps it going, a self-propelling sort of process. The next part of the five khandhas, that is fueled by the previous form of the five khandhas.
What
Of course, yeah, go on. What's the problem, yeah? It's a problem.
Sorry, liking.
Yeah.
Disliking is no problem, but wanting to push it away.
Oh, I see what you mean there. But even like liking and not liking would lead to a wanting. So it's a measuring. Yes, if you didn't have the awareness of the likes and dislikes clicking into the fuel, but even so, the likes and the dislikes, the preferences, the measurement does lead to control. Here, I just go to an analogy that I've used before of Lord Kelvin, one of the founders of the so-called Industrial Revolution, who said about 200, 300 years ago that in order to control nature, you have to learn how to measure it accurately, first of all, which is why we had standard weights and measures, and a lot of effort was made to create like a standard meter rod, which is in France somewhere. Standard weights, standard time, clocks, have maybe a millisecond every million years or something in error, so we have time to standardize things, and then we can have control. Measurement is a prerequisite for control. And it's only when we don't measure, we can't control. And now we come to all the stuff with Facebook and Google, getting your metadata. It's a means to control people. And of course, everyone knows that. If you don't measure, no likes, no dislikes. Of course, you can't control. And I go now over to Mahayana, the third Zen patriarch's famous poem. Opening line, the path is easy for one who has no preferences. No likes, no dislikes.
Well, you know, Bhante, there's some really interesting information that's come out just recently in the last couple of years about liking and not liking.
Yeah.
Liking and not liking versus wanting and not wanting. And therefore, you know, the brain scans show you there's places in the basal ganglia in the brain where you can actually have the first two states exist without the second two following on.
Yes, but then sometimes the brain doesn't work at all. And there are still some very pleasant experiences going on. So this is beyond the brain.
Okay.
Which is, brain scans can be illustrative, indicative, but exactly, you know, are they definitive? And that's what I...
No. No. The mind is...
Yeah.
More, trumps the brain. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Ajahn, is the distinction between desire and wanting about present and future?
Desire and wanting, present and future. It is whenever there is a future, there's a place where wanting can land. When you want something, there has to be some perception of a future. I want to be here, I want to be there, I want to be in a place where this doesn't exist, which is not the aversion, in brief. So you do have to have some perception of time as well.
So does the word desire relate to the present and wanting to the future?
No, they're not that sort of distinctive, desire and wanting. You know, just basically the same as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, it is desire and wanting that is part of these five components of existence, that is the fuel that sustains them. And just also, just when we get to the upadana, the fuel, it does have a definition of upadana, which is actually I never put in here. Maybe I should add it, because I'm always updating this work, Word of the Buddha, which is found in the Samaditti Sutta, which is, I think, number 9 of the Majjhima Nikaya, where Sariputta mentions the four types of upadana, what we call fuel or maybe craving, whichever you wish. The first of those is called karma upadana. It's the fuel of just the five sense experiences. Sometimes the people in brief say just the fuel of like happiness or any of the five senses. That fuel which keeps you going in life to see pleasant sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches, or to get rid of unpleasant ones, or just to explore that world. And it's amazing that even though a person's not really seeking pleasure, sometimes these things are painful, but there's a sense of interest to actually to go to places which might be a bit tough for you. You know, the Bear Grylls. I mean, why a fellow like that? Of course, I've never seen his programs, but I've heard about him. He goes to these remote places which are just so unpleasant. What does he do that for? But anyway, there may be another sort of something which needs a brain scan. I should have a brain scan of Bear Grylls when he's eating a scorpion or something. That would be interesting to see. But here we are, the upadana, the karma upadana is number one, just wanting just these experiences, the five senses. And the second one is the upadana of wrong view, dit upadana. And so the third one is silabhat upadana, the fuel of this is where clinging can sometimes be an interesting translation, where rites and rituals, thinking of that as a path to liberation. We have to do some chanting. If you chant long enough all the time, then you'll be liberated. And the last one is the view of a self. And these are the classic four upadanas, which you have the fuel of the five senses and five sense world, but the last three are all about views and ideas. And as Jnana Tiloka noticed when he sort of wrote the Buddhist dictionary, first edition of that, he noticed that this is something wrong here, because it doesn't look as if there's any upadana left for, say, a non-returner, an anagami. Because those four upadanas, which are listed by Venerable Sariputta, there's no sort of attachment to the five sense world, there's no fuel of the five sense world, the anagami is done with that. And of course, there's no belief in any self view, or any wrong views, or any attachment or belief or fuel of the rites and rituals. So why is that not there? No upadana for the anagami. And that was a little bit sort of challenging for even Venerable Jnana Tiloka. So he said, oh no, it's a mistake there. The karma upadana just means just also for the attachment to the other two worlds of the jhanas and arupa realms. But that obviously doesn't make any sense. The point is that it's a fuel. The fuel has run out for the anagami. But they only keep going because of like momentum. Your car runs out of petrol down the freeway. It doesn't immediately stop. The momentum which you have to keep going will keep going until it eventually comes to a stop. The anagami's fuel supply is exhausted. And eventually they're going to come to a stop. Momentum. Make any sense? Still has conceit, and I am, but that's of the thought. It's not of the view. So, okay, this is where we go into I don't mind sort of going off on these tangents, because this is great, because you can read this in books, but just discussion which it generates is probably the most important part of these classes. This is where we have the Buddha's description of the distortion of the cognitive process, called the vipalasas. And he said, well, what we've, first of all, you can start anywhere, view, perception, thought. So whatever, say, is your view, then that will distort perception. Basically, you will not be able to be aware of things which very challenge your worldview. You just can't see it. And of course, that example of the flower pot experiment, which I mention so often, which I got from my friend Bernard, that there a flower pot rose in the air, but even a trained experimental physicist just didn't even see it. It was blocked from his perception, even though it happened. So it's a view can distort your perception. From perception, that is where we build up our thoughts. We use our perception to justify our thoughts. Yeah, I was there, I saw it. And from our thoughts, it reinforces our views. And this is actually where that process is unreliable, which is why we have people of different religions who are totally sure that they are correct. And when it comes to the conceit, this is the residual habitual tendency, even though the anagami knows there is no self there, still it hasn't, the view has been straightened up, but still the perceptions and the thoughts still are conditioned from the past that hasn't totally disappeared. And a simile which when Kemmerer used, he was the anagami who, when he was teaching this, saw through what the last little bit of attachment, last little bit of wrong of conceit, was that it's like when you wash your robe. When you wash your robe, you hang it on the line, there's still the scent, the fragrance of the washing powder. And it takes a while for that fragrance of the washing powder to dissipate, to disappear. And that's the same with once one's seen, one's got right view. So it takes a while for those old habits to actually totally disappear. So one can still have those conceits, even though one knows that they're wrong. They're unjustified. Okay. But it's a deep dharma, but it's worthwhile talking about. Anyway, next. Any kind of body whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the body component of existence, and all bodies should be seen as they really are with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not a permanent essence. And the meaning of this is the Buddha is trying to incorporate every type of body, not even like some cosmic body, some godly body, all bodies, or the body which is comprised of all existence. Every type of body, past, future, or present, one's own or others, even a Buddha's body, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the body component of existence. All bodies should be seen as they really are with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not a permanent essence. You don't own your body. You can't identify with your body. This is not who you really are. And the point here is trying to be totally inclusive of every type of body. And that's important when we get to the other components of existence. Any kind of experience whatever, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the experience component of existence. and all experience should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. You don't own experience. This is not, this I am not. You're not your experience, you're not your bliss. And that's an important point, because sometimes when a person gets into sort of like even a first jhana experience, very blissful, think, oh, this is the real me, this is my essence. This is, you know, almost like a godly feeling. This is where you have that verse in the Psalms, the Christian book, be still and know that thou art God. You can see this, where that illusion comes from. Yeah, just bathed in pure love, not different than pure love, bliss, ecstasy, and there's no separation there. You've merged into the what can very easily be perceived as the ultimate. If that's as far as you've gone, you can't even conceive or suppose there's anything higher than that, but of course there is. But there, you can see this emerging in an absolute bliss, and that's so powerful, so unified, that a person can identify that, this I am, this is the real me. And this is not a permanent essence. It all disappears. Any feeling, any sort of experience is not permanent. So this is where a person feels that if, say, they go to some nirvana where they live happily ever after, happiness is never ever after. It's not a permanent essence. Fortunately, suffering is not permanent either. And that's the experience components. Any kind of perception, whatever, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the perception component of existence. All perception should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not a permanent essence. This is not yours. So do you own perception? Do you control it? Or is your perception controlled by something else? Basically, can you trust your perception? Any kind of will, so we're getting to really challenging stuff now. Any kind of will and other mental formations, whether past, future, or present, just leave it at will a moment. Any kind of will, whatever, past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the will component of existence. All will should be seen as they really are, with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not a permanent essence. Your will, is that who you are? Imagine that you forsake your will as a permanent essence. Whose fault was it? Not me. I didn't do it. You're still living in this world where other people think you're responsible. Yes, you have to take that responsibility, because that's what other people impose on you. But nevertheless, when you look at your will, when it's not yours, then you can let it go. Just like that simile of being a visitor to Bodhinyana, or being an abbot of Bodhinyana, the place where I live. If I'm always an owner of Bodhinyana, I suffer. If I'm a visitor, I can just be free and appreciate its beauty. If you own your will, you will suffer. You make mistakes. Not saying the will doesn't exist, but you are not the owner. If you're just a visitor, will comes, will goes, you're just a visitor, then the suffering can lessen immensely and be on the way out. So you don't identify as a one who does, who chooses. And any kind of consciousness whatever, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is a consciousness's component of existence. All consciousnesses should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom. Thus, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not a permanent essence. So even your consciousness, the one who is listening, the one who is thinking, the knower, is that a permanent essence? Is that you? Anyway, who's that speaking? Yeah, who's that with his hands up? Just five candles.
Come behind with the penetration into that this is not me, this is not mine, the will has disappeared. So all those past actions.
That's a very good point.
You can see it as...
Angulimala had done a lot of terrible deeds, a serial killer. And when the Buddha sort of taught him that, you know, he became fully enlightened, an arahat. Still had to experience some physical karma, people just throwing stones at him. But the deeper story is that when a person becomes a stream winner, they've become a sotapada, not on the path, but actually stream winning, they're no longer subject to rebirth in the lower realms. Even at a stream winner, any bad karma you have, you can let go of. You've seen non-self. So thereby, you don't take such responsibility and ownership as you had before. When you realize that just, you know, using that metaphor of Bodhinyana Monastery, that when I realize it's not mine, I don't own it, then you don't suffer. But if I think I'm responsible for that, and that's almost like an extension of me, and people praise it, oh yeah, and the people criticize it, I'm in trouble now, then that type of ownership, that is where you get suffering. Okay, and now we go into even more detail about the components of existence. What is the form body of existence, the body? It is the four great elements and the physical qualities derived from the four great elements, just stuff. What are the four great elements? The earth, water, fire and the air element. Oops. The experience component of existence. There are these three types of experience. What are the three? Pleasant, through any of the six senses, unpleasant, through any of the six senses, neither unpleasant nor pleasant, neutral experience through any of the six senses. These are the three types of experience. And again, I mentioned I don't like the idea of a feeling, because even those three, pleasant, yeah, you can say what pleasant, unpleasant, but in between, neutral, because even neutral experience, I mean, they have something like the fourth jhana, where that there is no pleasant experience or unpleasant experience five senses or in the sixth sense. There's only the upeka, the neutral feeling. But then sometimes even Sariputta calls that upeka sukha, the pleasure of no pleasure. He's not trying to be clever and being a Zen master. It is saying just the absence of things compared to their being there is pleasant. That pleasure and pain, happiness and suffering, there is a relativeness there. So sometimes even say the neither unpleasant nor unpleasant experiences, that's a little bit hard to understand. What is perception? There's six kinds of perception of sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and perception of mental objects. Doesn't really tell you very much. The will and the result of willing. That's the karma formations. The will and the result of willing, component of existence. And what are volitions? There are the six kinds of volition with regard to sights, will regarding sounds, will regarding smells, will regarding tastes, will regarding touches, and will regarding mental objects. And here they actually mention the Chaitanya. So it's very clear over here that the Buddha is actually meaning the sankharas to be mostly about will. And the consciousness is component of existence. What are the consciousnesses? There are these six kinds of consciousness: sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mind consciousness. That's one of the reasons why, you know, you can't just call this component of existence consciousness. It's consciousnesses. And that tiny difference in rendering has a huge difference in how one understands the use of these Buddhist terms. And the any pause or any comments? The way it sort of does change the way that we understand or we the meaning of the Buddha's teachings, that sometimes if we just call this fifth kanda consciousness single, we have the idea there's always the same consciousness always running through the different sensory experiences, like a string running through a series of beads. You may have five different beads, or maybe even a sixth bead, all different colors, and the string running through every part of your experience is what you identify as consciousness. But as the Buddha taught it, to be precise, was different consciousnesses. There is no string running through, you know, your flow of experience. All there is just a sight experience followed by a knowing experience, a mind. Then maybe another sight, another mind, another sort of maybe smell, and then a mind. Different beads, one after the other, with nothing running through them. Breaking off the continuity of this thing we call conscious experience. One of the similes which I used was like you go to sort of Cottesloe Beach and you just look at that sand stretching from the north to the south and you think there's a continuous sand, but then you go closer and you feel the individual particles of silica. There's not just a continuous piece of sand. It's made up of particles, tiny particles, admit it. And even some of those particles are not touching. The space between them. Our flow of conscious experience is like the grains of sand. Spaces between them. Nothing flowing from one grain of sand to the next grain of sand. Like our conscious experience. Okay, you got your hand coming up, Chris.
Different sense consciousnesses together to give a sense of continuity. Does the Buddha talk about binding, a binding consciousness or a mechanism which tricks us into thinking that they are in continuity? Is there some mechanism there within the mind?
There's only mechanism which can remotely be described as that is delusion. Mm-hmm. It is just the same as when, well, you know, you're not that much younger than me. I remember going to these seaside resorts in UK, and they had these little machines, what the butler saw, you know, what was supposed to be a bit raunchy, you know, and you put the penny in the slot and you... just a series of pictures, you know, which move so fast. it looked like they were continuous. And obviously from there you've got the silent films, which are just frames which run so fast it gives you the illusion of continuity. And even I'd imagine on high definition TV sets, it's still little pixels which are illuminated, and of course then they have to sort of turn off so quickly that it looks as if this is just like real life, like it's a continuous, smooth movement. Well, we all know it's not. Life is fractal, if you know your mathematics.
Thank you.
Point, point, point. It gives you the illusion of continuity.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So the consciousness component of existences. What are the consciousnesses? There are six kinds of consciousness. As I said, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mind. And the dependent origination of consciousness, to show that consciousness is not a continuous thing. It arises and passes away according to its causes. It's dependently originated. So, if the sense of knowing, mind, is viable, but no mind objects come into its range, then there is no appearance of mind consciousness. If the sense of knowing is viable, mind objects come into its range, but there is no conscious engagement, then there's no appearance of mind consciousness. But when the knowing is viable, mind objects come to its range, and there is a conscious engagement, then the mind consciousness manifests. So sometimes the mind consciousness is there, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it manifests, sometimes it's just not there. So even mind consciousness, what most people think is their essence, who they are, the consciousness, this flow, it's not always there. It's only when the things come together. The knowing is viable and mind objects come into its range. It needs something to know. And then those two come and they engage, then is what we call mind consciousness. And so with the other five senses and the origination, each of their own type of consciousness. Consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on sight and visual objects, it's reckoned as sight consciousness. As consciousness arises dependent upon hearing and sounds, it's reckoned as hearing. Consciousness arises depending on smell and odors, it's reckoned as smell consciousness. Consciousness arises dependent upon taste and flavors. It is reckoned as taste consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent upon touch and tangibles, it is reckoned as touch consciousness. And when consciousness arises dependent upon the mind and mind objects, it is reckoned as mind consciousness. Whatsoever there is of form belongs to the form component of existence. Whatsoever there is of experience, this belongs to the experience component of existence. Whatsoever there is of perception, this belongs to the perception component of existence. Whatsoever there is of will and other mental formations, sankhara, this belongs to the will component of existence. Whatever there is of consciousnesses, this belongs to the consciousnesses component of existence. So that excludes everything else. If it's consciousness, any type of consciousness, it belongs in the five components of existence. Any experience, any perception, any will belongs in these five. So if there's something outside of the five, it can't be conscious. It can't have any will. It can't even have any perception. It can't qualify in any sense as a being or an essence or something which exists. Go on.
What is Gandhabha then?
Sorry?
Gandhabha, what is now in this, there is an expression called Gandhabha in that.
Oh, the Gandhabhas, yes.
Mother's womb.
Yeah.
In this, in the light of this explanation.
Yes. The Gandhabha is a little bit sort of off tangent, on a tangent here. It's off subject. But a Gandhabha literally means like fragrant. Yeah. It's, you know, fit to be smelled, to be sensed with the nose. Gandhabha. Which is a fascinating thing, because the idea was that this is, you know, from the mythology of that time, that when a being descended into a mother's womb, you know, when the first consciousness took root there, the stream of consciousness, that it was accompanied by these other fragrant beings, the Gandhabhas. They assisted in the conception moment. It was just an idea at that time. Of course, there's no evidence based at all. But from that, there was also a little confusion. They say that when the being about to enter a person's womb, that particular time in the stream of consciousness, you know, in the flow of a human being, you know, from one birth into another, when they're about to enter the mother's womb, the future mother's womb, they just call that the Gandhabha.
There is the consciousness there.
Oh, Gandhabha, yeah.
And then there must be, as you say, I think that what you explained, Ajahn, the fragrance,
yeah,
it must be very remnants of other khandhas, like, otherwise consciousness cannot exist just by on its own.
Yeah, no, it does need to have some object of consciousness.
So what, fragrance?
Yeah, well, it's, again, you've heard me tell that story. I can't tell about previous lives, but just, you know, early life memory as a little baby in the pram, recognizing everything by its smell, and finding out from a gynecologist that that's the first sense which a being develops when they come out of the mum's womb. Now, of course, we're mostly sight-dominated. The seeing is the most dominant sense for many people. But for a baby, it's a smell. And I'm going too far here. I always got to be careful of not sort of making any claims or stuff, but certainly when you have these early life memories, even more so past life memories, it's, you're right there back again, you're experiencing things. So you know what it feels like, and it's very clear, you can remember these things so clearly. And you know, this is how a baby knows their world. They don't see mum and dad. Smell them. So it's nice to when you have experiences like that. So it's not theory anymore, you know, just you know what it's like. So anyway, so early babies, smell is the most important part of them. Anyway, how are you going? Am I leaving many of you discombobulated? That's my favorite words. Okay, anyway, we're just, how's the time going? It's 4:04. The next part of, nothing I can go on. There's a couple of very important points here. What is the sankhara component of existence, the fourth component of existence? And the definition of sankhara is the six types of will, the chedana kaya. Will engage with the objects of the six senses. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. Because I acknowledge Ajahn Bhamani for this one, I said, well, where in the suttas? The Buddha always seems to be meaning the sankhara means the will, the chetana. But where is, you know, what you have found in your readings and research, the most obvious place? And he quoted the Samyutta 22, the Kanda Samyutta, the six types of will. And just as an aside, a chetanakaya. Chetanakaya means just a group of things, it means a collection of things. And obviously I've used that whenever I start to talk about anapanasati, to hold the whole body of breath. It doesn't mean a physical body, it means like the grouping of, you know, all the different moments of breath, from the beginning of an in-breath to the end of the in-breath, space between the in-breath and the out-breath, and all those feelings of the out-breath from beginning to end. It's the meaning of the word kaya in sort of Pali. Similar to the meaning of the word kaya as body, sort of in English, a body of evidence, a body of truth. Anything, it doesn't have to be physical. It just means a collection of stuff. So anyway, that was where the sankhara, instead of calling it mental formations, which, what do they really mean? But when it says will, that makes this a very powerful statement. And, yeah. Okay, just kidding.
Six types of will.
Yeah, oh, well, so that's a very good point.
So there's not six one types will?
Of will, yeah. Six types of will, but it's the will engaged with the objects of the six senses. So the will in the sense of being, that's a very interesting question. It's quite true. It's a will engaged with seeing, which is different than a will engaged with mind, and I think you're onto something there. So when
because you've opened up my mind to vijnana.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a threshold concept to me.
Yes, yes.
But I just want to understand what you mean here.
Indeed, because as many people say, is that you know you don't decide sometimes to look at something. Sometimes the eye just goes and looks almost automatically. The ear has its own sort of sense of will. So when you hear a sound, bang or something, you can't sort of, it does it by itself. It's almost like a will just associated with hearing. And of course there's a will associated with the mind which can maybe interfere in sort of listening to something which is, are they talking about me or something? You don't listen, which is as if that you decide to do that. Become something which is automatic, irresistible. The ear decides to go over there. It's not your mind telling you to listen. Does that make sense?
Of course, I'm just kind of like, you've just opened me up to this.
Yeah.
So
well, that's good. I think you're onto something.
I can't say I understand, but I'm at a threshold.
I think you're onto something there. Different types of will associated with different senses.
Because it sounds as if it's on the same thread as
exactly.
Consciousness.
Yeah, and wills. Yeah, I think you're onto something there.
It seems like it's more simply based on cause and effects, and really it's all jumbled up, and there's nothing there as an agent.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, will has always been the will.
Yeah, exactly. Well done. Anyway, though someone might say, and this answers a little bit about the Gandhava, apart from form, apart from experience, apart from perception, apart from will, I will make known the coming and going of consciousnesses, their passing away and rebirth, their growth, increase and expansion. That is impossible. In other words, the consciousness of that being entering the mother's womb has to have the other four khandhas there as well. You can't have one without the other. You can't have bare consciousness without anything to be conscious of. Then the usual simile, just as two sheaves of reeds might stand leaning against each other, so too, with the objects of consciousness as a condition, consciousness comes to be. With consciousness as a condition, the objects of consciousness come to be. You can't have one without the other. You can't have just pure consciousness, just knowing, without knowing something. And also there is, this is just something on the grammatical form of consciousness. Consciousness, as many of you know, is called vijnana. Vijnana. Jnana means knowing. Vijnana means jewel. Vi is the same as bi, like bicycle, like binary. It means, say, what's that word? Africa. It means like you have to have two things to have vijnana, a good and a bad. Vijnana is also has to have some dualism there. To know something, and if that something stays the same again and again and again, you can't know it. You can only know things which change. Vijnana, a differentiated knowing. Go on. You on the microphone.
Is it the same as reification? Where experience breaks up into I and the knower and the known? Is that what you're talking about?
No, that's included, but it's much more than that, much more general than that. Even like, you know, happiness. Happiness could only exist with its opposite suffering.
Okay, thank you.
You can't know one without the other, which is one of the reasons why if it's just pure consciousness, it never changes, it won't exist. So, an idea of a pure, absolute cosmic consciousness, sort of like an all-knowing cosmic being of God or whatever, you would have to have sort of the God experiencing suffering to experience happiness. Kind of one without the other.
That's really interesting because what they found from fMRI scans is that people's perception of people's consciousness actually is a function of change happening in the brain. When that change
Good.
Stops.
Change. Exactly. If change stops, you're unconscious.
Yeah.
Vijnana. Bi. It's almost like bipolar. Okay. Yes, Nicholas.
Ajahn, can the same be said of the wills and all the other khandhas?
You have to will something.
Are they all codependent so that if they don't have their objects, they
cease? Oh, yeah, sure. If you don't have anything you want,
so
will vanishes.
In that sense, are they like... So could you look at each one of them as you look upon the description of dependent consciousness?
Yeah, sure, yes. I never mentioned that because it did actually say that just as... you can't, what was it, whatsoever there's a form, I stopped there somewhere. Consciousness is, when the sense of knowing is viable, mind objects come into its range and there is conscious engagement, the mind consciousness manifests, and so with the other five senses and the origination of each their own type of consciousness. So, and also with the other types of will as well, the arising of will.
So, if they have no object, they can't exist?
Yeah, so your will stops. That's second jhana.
Is that the same for the other components as well?
Components of existence, yeah, you have to have the consciousness there to have the other, except for the asanyasata, but that's almost like just a limbo, like on hold. You can't maintain that forever. That's only got the four khandhas. So not only the one khanda, just form, but none of the other senses. But that's like a temporary. Lasts a few eons, by the way, but even that's temporary.
So that's still a conditioned state, though, isn't it, Ajahn?
Of course it's a conditioned state, yes.
So in that sense, it can't continue.
Can't continue forever, no, indeed. Okay, I think that's enough deep teachings for today. Just discombobulated every one of you, probably. But anyway, that leads us to the three characteristics of existence for the next time. But we have a few questions from overseas. Let's do this first of all. Oh, no, two questions, that's nice. From Winnipeg, and also from Canada to Canada, Daniel and George. People who have a near-death experience often report continuation of self and sensation. What is this self that transfers from life to death? It is the stream of consciousness. It is the perception, just like now, that is a sense that there's been a continuity from the time when you first came in this hall at 3 o'clock until 4:15. You know, and it's very hard to see just a fragmentary nature of all those experiences for the last 45 minutes. And it's the same when the body stops, the mind, that sixth sense is still happening, and it often takes on a mind-made body. So people who are dead, sometimes they appear as if that they are just in the clothes you put them in their coffin. And that is the classic case of that, was one of the people who used to come here some years ago called Victor. And he was in the sort of the developing industry, but he's had a friend, a builder from Kalgoorlie, and he brought him over here because his friend had cancer and was dying, and he thought maybe just, you know, come and see Ajahn Brahm might help him. But then maybe a few weeks later, he died. And so Victor just rushed over to Kalgoorlie in the aircraft to actually to see his friend, you know, but in the coffin. And then they cremated him. And a few days later, Victor woke up in the middle of the night. Somebody nudged him in the chest, and he turned around to his wife to tell her off for waking him up, and saw his wife was fast asleep. So turned around, and there was his friend, the builder from Calgary, Australian. But what really shocked him was that his friend was dressed in a suit and a polka dot bow tie. And if you ever met Australian builders, that is not their usual costume. Even when he came to see me, he was dressed in, you know, shorts and singlet. He's a builder. And so, you know, an on-site builder, not just one who just sits in the office and tells other people what to do. And so he was so shocked, and he turned around to his wife, woke her up, Mel, and then, of course, this builder friend disappeared. So he just got up, both of them, searched the house for him. Silly thing to do. But then come and told me about the experience and said, but this must be dreaming this, because I've never seen him in such fancy clothes. So that's, of course, great. Now you go and ring the widow. You know, and just talk, are you okay, everything okay, anything I can do for you? And just in passing, you know, not to make this the central part of your phone call. Oh, by the way, what was he wearing in his coffin? And of course, his wife said, he was wearing a suit and a bow tie, polka dot bow tie. He said, I've never seen him wear that. He said, no, I bought it for him for his birthday. He refused to wear it, men being men. So I thought, at least I can dress him up properly in his coffin when he can't complain. And that was a wonderful little anecdote. It's unexpected to see this builder dressed like that. Not at all. Even seeing a ghost was unexpected, but seeing him dressed like that was doubly challenging, but it was true. So usually, whatever you dress with in, when you die, sometimes that becomes your mind-made body for those moments of your existence. So it is what you assume you are wearing, just how you carry on that relationship, you know, with your body. So it is the stream of consciousness. It's not a self, stream of consciousness, which goes after death into a mind-made body and then often into a rebirth. Okay, we cannot avoid having experiences. How can we train our mind not to invest in them so the link from feelings to craving can be broken? You don't break links of dependent origination. You only just overcome avijja, delusion. When you see things for what they truly are, from that point, that dependent origination is 11 links of dependent origination. Not 12 links, count them. There's 12 things which are linked by 11 links, if you like. So anyway, so those links, if you like, it's undermined at avijja. Once avijja is, no, delusion is seen through, then the whole chain unravels. Of course, you can't avoid having experiences, but you can see them for what they are, as just not me, not mine, not a self, full of suffering, and where they're coming from, especially the five sense experiences, first of all, to see them for what they are, and eventually you just have a sense of nibbida towards them, and dispassion, they fade away, and then you get into the jhanas, when the five sense vedana are not there, and even in the jhanas, that even that mental vedana can vanish. So you can see them, all the vedana disappearing. So you can avoid them by calming the mind down, getting into deep meditation, and you can be just experience them vanishing. Okay, any other questions? Comments? Oh, you have one. Oh, but, oh dear, I thought I was done. Okay. See, the body is suffering. I'm experiencing now. Go on.
Ajahn, I understood that the wheel is just a delusion, but yet you talk a lot about it today.
About delusion?
No, the wheel.
The wheel.
Is just a delusion. That.
Yeah, it's...
But you actually talked a lot about different types of wheels, as if it actually exists.
It exists, but we're deluded, we give it a meaning it doesn't deserve. And the simile is of seeing the mirage, seeing the water on the road on a hot day, and of course there's no water on the road on a hot day, it's just the inversion of the air. So it bends the light to appear like water, like a puddle on the road. It exists, that you're not imagining that light which comes to your eyes is real, but you're giving it a meaning it doesn't deserve. Will is, but we're giving it a meaning it doesn't deserve. We're attributing that this is ours, it's me, it's part of myself, and thereby I will not give it to anybody. If I come along and say, John, I'm taking over your mind, I'm controlling your will, look into my eyes, follow my hand, you are becoming under my... People get scared that way. Taking over your will? But the point is, we think it's ours. So we're finding out the will is, it's a phenomena, but we're giving it a meaning it doesn't have, as if it comes from us. Rather, understanding is conditioned, causes. Yeah?
It's cause and effect, and the will's just a name, is that right?
Yeah, it's a name, but it describes a phenomena which you associate occurs before you act by body, speech or mind. Before body, speech or mind is something which you can perceive as what you believe originates, you know, putting that question forward. There's a decision, if you like, which you can see is before the action. It doesn't originate the action, but because it happens before and you can associate the action afterwards, you attribute that is the cause of it. And thereby, we believe that we willed it.
Thank you.
Okay. So, I think I can go now. Yeah. Okay, enough. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, so for those of you who just want to check on this and have a look again, it is on sort of the website, but don't sort of share it around because I'm trying to get this work published. So hopefully if too many people share it on the internet, then no one will publish it because they get it for free. I'm trying to publish it to get it a wider circulation. Okay, so there we go. The next one, next time I'm here. Carry on.